We're actually getting a lot of feedback from all the platforms. Recently, we published a big report to our supporters on what we have achieved in 3 months since we started. And one of the most surprising things were the comments starting pouring in and people explaining back to us why they think Ukrainian spaces are important for them. So I wanted to just read out loud some of them because this is something, first of all, very nice to hear from all of you, but then kind of explains even better why Ukrainian spaces exist and what kind of a goal we pursue here. So here's from one of our listeners saying that you guys are my favorite show. I look at how long an episode is and I think I don't have 55 minutes, and suddenly you and Val are saying it's time to wrap up, and I'm thinking already, great work, please keep going. And there's another one from Elena. First of all, Ukrainian Spaces was a truly safe space to listen to experiences that most of us have been dealing through this war, but had no one to share with us. In my honest opinion, exceptionally present for long-term migrants. Second, of course, covering the war from a Ukrainian perspective and decolonizing media spaces that usually don't give coverage for Ukrainians at all. You're a big inspiration, Slava Ukraini. And here's another one from one of our sponsors. I'm still catching up on Ukrainian spaces, but after listening, reading a few, in addition to the content flowing with truth and integrity, your respect and warmth to the people who you join is just so heartwarming. Thank you so much for this show. And another one from comment from our podcast page, which is something, again, super important. If you listen to us on Apple or Spotify, please do leave your ratings and comments, of course, because we love to read through them, but also because it allows us to trend on those platforms. And here's one of the comments left under our show on Apple Podcast saying, I'm blown away by this podcast, really educational and important for Westerners to hear. Made me realize just how wrong the conversation around Ukraine has been and how few Ukrainian voices are featured in traditional media. Thank you for your work on the podcast and outside. Slava Ukraini. The last thing before I go to our featured Ukrainian is reminder about our Patreon page, because Ukrainian Spaces is 100% independent, volunteer and listener supported effort. And without you guys, we won't be able to do this. That's a lot of work. And the part of the reason why you love Ukrainian Spaces is because we actually spend a lot of time making it and preparing it and finding the topics, finding the guests. So without your support, it won't be possible. Thank you so much. But also, this is not a charity. You get a lot of bonus stuff through our Patreon space page. So please do check out and consider becoming our sponsors. Yosef, are you with us here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Super. Slava Ukraini.
Slava Ukraini.
Look, we have I know that you listen to some of our shows and you've been always often kind of there in the background. So I'm very excited that today is your time to be in, so to say, spotlight. But you also probably know our golden rule that we never introduce ourselves, our featured Ukrainians, and we let them to introduce themselves the way they want it. So please educate and share with others who you are, what's your name, what's your life been since the genocide, and whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So I'm based in the UK, in London. I grew up here to a Ukrainian mother and I suppose half Polish father. My family is all from Western Ukraine, from all over really, but from Lviv, from Ivano-Frankivsk. and I have kind of friends scattered all over the place as well. For the majority of my career, I've been a journalist working for news organizations here in the UK. And last year, I started a candle company called Panko, or Panko, if you want to anglicize it, which was kind of an attempt. Well, it was translating a hobby of mine into a kind of way to showcase Ukrainian culture, to explore further Ukrainian culture and to kind of bring it into people's homes through, you know, basically creating candles, creating fragrance. So yeah, that's what I'm up to at the moment. In terms of my background in the UK, yeah, as I said, I grew up here. I was speaking Ukrainian at home first, and kind of learned English when I went to school. And then after that, continued to attend a Ukrainian school, which is in London, in Holland Park in West London. So I kind of had this kind of ebbing and flowing connection really with Ukraine. Like, I'm, you know, I'm fluent in Ukrainian, but obviously sound incredibly English. So it's kind of a strange way to be, where people don't necessarily think of you as Ukrainian when they first meet you, obviously, because you don't sound like it and you don't kind of look any different from people who live here. So yeah, I guess if I was to sort of tail off that introduction, it would be that as I've got older, I've definitely found, I suppose, more of a community of fellow Ukrainians, both online and around the UK, kind of reconnect with and to feel much more at home with that part of my identity. Yeah.
You haven't lost your connection in a way with words. And I love what you do on social media and post some of the perspectives, especially now that a lot of Ukrainians, especially abroad and those from diaspora, are reconnecting with our roots in a new way. I mean, all of this genocide. But one of the things that I really wanted to feature and bring spotlight to is your note that you posted on your Ukrainian identity and how you are reconnecting with it. I mean, the war.
Yeah.
Could you tell everyone else a bit about it? I'm going to pin it on during our conversation right now as well for everyone else to check later.
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, so I was actually encouraged to do this by my partner because I'm kind of, since kind of moving away from journalism, I've actually been very kind of shy to write, like, because I kind of, I don't know, I don't feel like I have much to say in terms of professional work anymore in that regard. I'm kind of worried about it not being good enough or whatever. So, yeah, she encouraged me to write something because I've been kind of talking about all these different things with her and, you know, sharing things. And basically, yeah, I wanted to start kind of a small section of my candle brand's website dedicated to writing about Ukraine, whether from me, whether from guest contributors. And the post to kind of kick things off was, yeah, me kind of talking about being in the UK, growing up in the UK, and how I'd seen the perception of Ukrainian identity change over time. I mean, there's sort of some funny aspects of it. I remember going on school trips and people like on the coach not knowing what rye bread was. I mean, I don't know what Britain was like, a famine, like culturally, like very ignorant in the 90s, where lots of these things that I was bringing from home, whether it was Bosch, whether it was Vereniki, were just seen as completely strange. And it seems really stupid to say that now because, you know, these are very normal foods, normal cultural things. But It was something that made people think, oh, this guy at school is a little bit different to the rest of us who have sandwiches when we go to the museum for a trip. And so there were all these sort of small differences where I started picking up on. And it was sort of strange because when, you know, Ukrainian culture is incredibly rich, incredibly bold, you know, whether it's, you know, incredible embroidery or singing or dancing or spoken word, you know, traditions being passed down between families or between villages. All of this is sort of, you know, as when I was a child growing up, it does mark you out as slightly different to everyone living here and who is from here. And it would almost be seen as slightly embarrassing because it would be like, okay, well, yeah, my family do this and we actually celebrate Christmas at this time of year, not like the normal time of year, like when you do it. And Easter is actually really huge for us and Christmas is like not so much, but Easter is huge. We, you know, we take baskets to the church and things like this. So there are all these like small things and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but it was just sometimes took extra explaining. And the problem was, is that one, I think, you know, and I kind of mentioned this in the piece, is that if you kind of were talking to people about this, you know, like this is what my family do and this is where we're from in the world, people would often just think, like, just kind of nod their heads and be like, oh, right, yeah, yeah, Russia, I understand. And you just be like, I haven't mentioned Russia at all. Like, it, like, no one in my family is like, is said that, you know, everyone is very, as a very proud Ukrainian, like, Russia has not been kind of mentioned as any kind of similarity really at all. But yet, it was the first thing that people would spring to because it was the way that I think culturally, you know, you also, if you look at kind of pop culture in the 90s, film, television, you know, those things, you know, Ukrainians and Russians were basically seen as interchangeable, you know, and whether they were like villains in James Bond films or like, you know, gangsters in a book or something like that, it was all basically seen as the same thing. And yeah. I think it causes, you know, as someone part of a diaspora community, it causes quite a lot of disconnect because even at a young age, you know, you're trying to explain that actually that's not where you're from.
For Ukrainians, of course, for single colonized nation.
Exactly.
Especially in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I mean, this is like a common theme, you know, amongst many people who've either had, you know, countries that are bordering with Russia or other colonized countries elsewhere in the world. So it was frustrating to have that kind of disconnect between the two, you know. I mean, just in terms of where things are now in terms of perception, I think it is a very strange, it's a very strange place to be where, you know, we're here 100 days after the sort of full escalation of the war began. And people now seem to have a much, much better understanding of, you know, what Ukraine stands for, how Ukrainians see themselves, you know, the traditions of Ukraine, etc. But it is also deeply sad and deeply, deeply upsetting that it literally took such a cataclysmic amount of war and destruction for this to happen.
Genocide.
And so we were already having these conversations about, you know, like, you know, Russia and its influence for basically my entire life. But
yeah, there is a very powerful passage from that note that I especially fancy when you remember how you were connecting with your Ukrainian identity through, you know, this, again, the science of what we now call the triumph of colonialism, when your identity is not being recognized at all, and often mixed or even equalized by with the identity of colonizers. So you write, we have been here before. Ukrainian artists, athletes, and writers were historically grouped under the Soviet Union and therefore considered Russians. Growing up in Britain in the 90s, when I told people my family was Ukrainian, they would generally say something like, oh, right, Russia. And one person's dad told his son that it was where Smirnov comes from. There are really minor things, but they serve to show how, as a Ukrainian, you are often required to patiently explain not only Russia's colonial relationship with your country, but the existence of your country itself. And I would also add probably existence of Ukrainian identity in general. It strikes me as especially powerful these days because, I mean, let's be honest, as Ukrainians who live in Ukraine or who were born in Ukraine, we've through many decades since the Ukraine became de facto independent, we had troubles connecting with Ukrainian diaspora. And there are so many of us between like at least 10 and 20 millions, just because Ukraine been so pummeled by colonialism, so many generations would just had to leave over and over again. But we had this problem connecting, you know, and I find it so fantastic that now this connection has established quite strong. I mean, of course, the circumstances are extremely horrific, but on the same time, no matter where we come from these days, we kind of are on the same page about our Ukrainian identity, don't you think?
Through this, particularly at the start of the kind of full-scale invasion, there were lots of people in London who I was able to connect with, you know, and kind of it almost felt like one thing led to another, and you were just almost constantly in a cycle of kind of meeting new Ukrainians to, you know, talk about this common thing, and even in our limited way, you know, in this part of the world, to try and help in some way. And I think that was really, really important. You know, I got a message of someone who owns a restaurant in central London, and, you know, they make like Chinese dumplings and things like that. And they were going to do a weekend where they made varenka, and donated everything to Ukrainian war efforts. So I went down there and donated a bunch of my candles I'd made. And then when I was there, met a guy called Dima, who makes vodka. He is from Kyiv, but he lives here. And then through him, ended up attending and participating in a fundraiser that was, as a local bar where they created an entire menu and were donating the entire night's takings to the same charity effort. And it just felt like there was this constant cycle of lots of Ukrainians being connected very quickly and using their skills together, you know, a completely diverse array of skills, really, to work together for this kind of common goal. And again, obviously, the common goal is kind of mitigation and is like trying to help in a really, really bad situation, but still really incredible to see almost new communities being formed that may not have actually connected at all otherwise. So it's not a huge consolation, obviously, but for the future, it kind of fills me with a lot of optimism because it means that, you know, we can strengthen those bonds in future and continue to work together, basically.
One of the first times when I connected with Ukrainian diaspora in a very meaningful way was in the UK, some years ago. I think it was quite a while ago. And of course, you know, before Maidan, or even after Maidan, it was honestly very hard to connect with a lot of our fellow Ukrainians from diaspora, because for them it was very hard to understand. I was very hard to understand and get how come a person who is not ethnically Ukrainian, who's like Georgian, you know, and Roma, and most importantly, Russian-speaking Ukrainian, how come I represent Ukraine? And, you know, we always had this a bit of tension because of that. But when I went to this camp, which is basically an old Ukrainian organization that helps with patriotic education of youngsters in diaspora. And for the first time ever, I was enveloped into this community that was extremely diverse, because diaspora was also diverse. People who would who came to the UK already in 2000s, so 2010s, and people who were living in the UK since, I don't know, 100 years, trying to preserve their Ukrainian roots and traditions. And then I saw people interacting, learning from each other, but also kind of rediscovering what Ukrainian means, apart from all these old school traditions of blood or geography or ethnicity. And back then I thought, man, that would be amazing if suddenly we were able to extrapolate this experience to every and each Ukrainian around the world. And now I feel like this is exactly what is happening, because when I talk to you, despite that we come from really different background experiences, well, not backgrounds, but we share the same experience of being Ukrainian, especially when it comes to, you know, what you just shared about being misidentified or labeled as Russian or other shit. This is just so speaks to me, and I understand you 100%, and it just fills me with so much joy.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, that point you make about moving away from that kind of old traditions and identity, and kind of forging something new, is something I definitely feel very strongly. It's weird because I think as someone who is who feels very culturally close to Ukrainian traditions as I was growing up, there is, it sort of fluctuates back and forth for me as part of my identity. And I've spoken to quite a few people in my position too, who went to school here in London, and attended a Ukrainian school as well. And they all say when you are born and you're young, very, very close to your family and your family ties. And then as you kind of grow up a little bit, you kind of want to forge your own path a bit. And so, you're in this English speaking, you're in England, everyone's speaking English all the time. Everyone is kind of very westernized, and you possibly start to assimilate a little bit and feel a bit more, like you're moving away from Ukrainian identity. But then really for a lot of people, and whether it prompts, people have various prompts. For me, it was definitely Maidan that prompted that kind of reconnection for me. I'd actually just started working at the Times in London, and it was on a completely, I was not on the news desk or anything, and I was the only Ukrainian speaker in the newsroom. So I was like, well, I could help you a lot here. And I was able to do some translation, but really I actually felt, despite having just started the job, I really felt a pull to want to just go. I wanted to just go to Kyiv, to see for myself, to participate or to connect with other Ukrainians. And I think ever since then, it's definitely, been much, much stronger.
When you were working as a journalist, did you ever cover the topics related to Ukraine? And if yes, I mean, did you have any kind of problems because you were also Ukrainian, And I'm just asking, of course, with a biased intent, because I've had so many similar experiences as a Ukrainian journalist trying to cover Ukraine and basically explained how not to do it or why I'm like not qualified to do it because I'm a Ukrainian, or treated by automatically with bias a bit. Oh, he's Ukrainian, he's probably going to do some biased crap about it.
I mean, the thing is, I actually did not end up writing anything, but I mainly was doing translation for other journalists who, you know, the Times is a very old school place, and that was where I spent the majority of my career. And it's very like, okay, cool, you know, you junior employee maybe have to help us a bit, but we need to send like, you know, the old guy to cover this. And so I definitely felt, you know, your second point about bias and things like that. You know, obviously I'd be translating, you know, very literally, you know, to kind of get everything down. But then I was kind of like, yeah, but you know, this guy you're talking to, you know, he's not going to give you like a particularly good perspective, you know, because he works for the, you know, these kind of Russia-aligned organizations or think tanks or whatever. And you were definitely kind of squashed down at that time. It was definitely very hard to just not even be particularly provocative, but just to kind of stand there and go, like, actually, you need to get another perspective. You need to speak to these people. You need to speak to these Ukrainian people who are on the ground, who are much, much closer to what it is you're trying to cover and trying to talk about, or, you know, better still, get them to write, you know, opinion and analysis pieces for you directly. Just go straight to the source.
Right.
But and that was really, really hard, because it's sort of a double-edged sword, because it's like, yes, okay, so I can help you with Ukrainian, so that's good. But because I can help you with Ukrainian, you don't want to hear my opinion about it, because you assume that I just, you know, I'm never going to side with anything to do with Russia, and that's bad because apparently that's not, you know, impartial or something. You know, it was very, very
Yeah.
difficult. So, you know,
If
journalism.
I can ask you, I mean, as can I call you a former journalist, or you're still identified as journalist?
Yeah, let's go former. Let's do that right now. Yeah.
Because I feel like maybe you have a bit of more liberty and freedom to talk and to comment on the current coverage that is happening, especially from British media, because they remain very important source of English language information about Ukraine. And this is something that also a source of frustration by from a lot of Ukrainians, because similarly to American media, there's a bit of disregard to Indigenous Ukrainian voices, and the representation is very low, and very often the coverage is misrepresents the situation on the ground, specifically because of reason that you mentioned, that there's this false balance being pursued, and it's sometimes, in my opinion, very prominent, specifically in British journalism, when we need to have this false balance no matter what, even if it means that we literally will force into the same space a fascist and a victim of fascism.
Yes, definitely.
So I know that a lot of journalists are listening to us. So as a person who's both British and Ukrainian, is there something you would like really to address in terms of what frustrates you the most in British English language coverage of Ukraine? So feel free to do that.
I think, yeah, if we talk sort of historically rather than in a specific moment to start with, like, yeah, there was always this sort of equivalence drawn. But like, firstly, you know, let's just talk about you know, the kind of occupation of Donbass, you know, places in the south. You know, the language, if you didn't know anything about the issues and you were reading these news reports that came from 2014 onwards, the language used makes it sound like it's just kind of like, oh, this is like a part of Russia, and Russia's there, so that's fine because it's part of Russia. And there are some pesky Ukrainians who don't agree with that, and the government in Kiev, you know, has enacted all these horrible policies, which means that everyone in the region wants to be Russian anyway. The language, like, there's sort of two things at play here. Firstly, the language used, but also the fact that the language used doesn't even seem aggressive. Like, it seems, if you're reading it as a impartial observer, that it's actually fine. You're not reading a provocative article. It reads as very sober. But unfortunately, you know, when you get quite sober, and I think, you know, things like, I think probably the New York Times is maybe the best example of this. It's so devoid of emotion almost that you kind of stop caring about the people involved and the stories involved, because it just reads like a very emotionless report that kind of seeks to flatten the effects of what they're actually talking about, which is illegal occupation of a country, invasion of a country,
right.
Driving out of Ukrainians, bussing in of Russians, things like this. And so I think things like that is just so important, because, you know, no one's asking you necessarily to, you know, write something that is just, you know, constantly, overflowing with emotion about how terrible everything is. But, you know, news reports generally tend to be quite straight down the line. But the thing is that ultimately there are some things you can't just be like, there are two sides to every story.
Yeah,
there are, but you choose to give each side a different weighting, a different weight. And if you give them equal weight, which is, you know, equal parts, some Ukrainians are annoyed that, you know, Russia is occupying their country. And then the other part is, but Russia says it has always been part of Russia. Those two things are not the same. Those two things should be examined for their veracity and, you know, for what they're actually based on. And I think really journalism is in a strange place, because economically it's been sort of living off essentially access to rich individuals funding it, or trusts or things like that, and has been economically in a bad way for a very, very long time. And so you get a situation where you can't fund the journalism that is, actually taking more time to look at the issues. And so you get these just very throwaway articles that to the people in offices, in journalism offices, may just seem like, oh, well, that's fine, that's an article, that's fine. But it has a real impact on people, you know, depending on who's being reported on. And so I think really, it's use of language, it's looking at different sources, and, you know, really, is this the easy route that I'm taking, or is it the route to actual truth? And journalists being pushed for time and funding, I think, too often take the easy route.
In no way I want to vilify the work, and there is a lot of great work done by Western journalists when it comes to Ukraine, and unfortunately some of them lost their lives recently, sacrificed their lives by telling the truth what is happening in Ukraine. And I think I've already said that before when we ask this question, our main goal is to help you guys to make a better job, not to vilify you, because if we thought that this is absolutely pointless, like it is with, for example, Russian propaganda, wouldn't even talk about it, right?
Yeah, it's probably going to make me sound too conspiratorial, but I think basically a lot of the time, the spread of information is still in too few people's hands, and is still too able to be influenced by a select amount of people who either have power or a particular agenda that they'd like to push politically. It's very interesting to me, really, because I think also just, you know, now that we're kind of 100 days in of this kind of new escalation, like, it's interesting at the start, seeing how I actually thought at the start, because so much was being essentially led by Ukrainians on the ground, by Ukrainian journalists, just by Ukrainian people all over the world. I actually think that at the very beginning of the invasion, there was quite a lot of good journalism being pushed to the fore. I think essentially, as some public interest has waned and has kind of fatigue has sort of set in, I think that means that those kind of old sources of information have kind of clawed their way back in and managed to start to influence the narrative a little bit more than at the start, because it caught a lot of them by surprise. They assumed something like that could never happen. And so it actually allowed, you know, people like the Kyiv Independent, plenty of other journalists who've been embedded in Ukraine for years, to actually lead the narrative. But yeah, I think now that's kind of swung back the other way, and kind of the old ways have restated themselves. You know, you're seeing TV correspondents fly home, you know, back to their studio, you know, having spent a lot of time in Ukrainian cities, you know, reporting, being cut back to sort of feeling like it's more in the background rather than leading stories. And I think that's...
Yeah, of course, Johnny Depp is much more important story for some.
Incredibly important, yeah.
I really want to have a shameless plug here and remind people that Ukrainian Spaces is exactly the reason it exists. And if you want to, if you also feel frustrated about this lack of representation or lack of coverage, please support us and donate through Patreon space, so we can keep, you know, keep working, keep doing the same. Joseph, or if I call you Joseph, this is also very nice. We really want need to wrap up, unfortunately. So I really want to go back to another favorite question, and about Ukrainian identity and what it means. And I know that in the beginning you kind of already touched upon this, but I also, by watching you and, you know, seeing your also transition away from journalist to other stuff that you're very good at and you love, I really wanted to ask you, with your new passion and trying to build a new life around the things that you really love, how's that kind of affects the way you feel as a Ukrainian, or what it means for you to be a Ukrainian? Because you also, in the same text that I'm coming back over and over again, your note, you built a beautiful bridge explaining how, for example, making candles and following the scents also allows you to be more connected to your Ukrainian roots. And if you don't mind sharing, I find it extremely beautiful, inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the piece is how, I'm looking at actually just some candle packaging of mine that's sitting on the shelf, and, you know, the names that are on there, you know, one scent is inspired by Odessa, another by Kyiv, another by the Carpathians, the forests and the mountains. You know, these are places that actually the average person in the UK maybe has not heard of, you know, and hilariously, like, quite a few people thought I'd maybe made a typing error in Kyiv when I typed it with a Y. K-Y-I-V, because they were used to spelling it the Russian way. So these things that may have seemed strange and alien to people to begin with are actually, they understand them now. They've read about them. They understand much more about Ukrainian culture. One shopkeeper I actually went to see when I was wanting to sell them some stuff for display in their shop, kind of dismissed what I was selling as Eastern European, basically. And I was kind of like, what do you mean by that? They said, it's like Poland, Ukraine, Russia, it's kind of all part of the same thing, right? And I was like, I'm talking to you about Ukrainian stuff. This is Ukrainian identity. I would be interested in visiting that same person now, with everything that's happened, and see possibly how they regard Ukraine differently as a result. My exploration of Ukrainian identity through starting a candle company has really been through getting into the depths of things like all the herbs that grow in Ukraine, for example, all the different flowers, really thinking about locales and geography and kind of the incredible mix of not only climates but atmospheres and cities around Ukraine. So there was a day where I was like, okay, I want to create something that feels unique to Ukraine and is guided by its geography and guided by the atmosphere there. So I went and got a load of books and researched specifically, going way back, Ukrainian folk tales and how certain herbs were used medicinally, and then how could I transport that into a modern day scent to show people how rich Ukraine's history is and how rich the culture is. And so now I'm at a point really where, I am selling fairly regularly. I'm meeting a lot of different people through the people that I sell to, not only shops but customers as well, and they all get very, very interested at something to them that seems very new. In this part of the world, Western Europe, culture like France, Spain, Italy is incredibly well known. You can walk down any high street, there will probably be possibly an Italian restaurant, possibly Spanish, things like that. Ukraine, not so much. And so it's really nice to be part of something that is directly contributing to people's knowledge and appreciation for Ukraine.
Thank you.
And hopefully, educating people and inspiring them.
This brings you even closer to Ukrainian roots, because Ukraine is just incredibly vibrant with the entrepreneurial spirit all the time through the ages. And this is something that a lot of folks back in Europe or outside the world don't know.
Yeah,
that we pride ourselves on small businesses and starting businesses, and it's not a recent thing. But also, it's just, when we talked before and you shared the story with me privately, I thought really deeply about the sense that I associate with Ukraine, and especially with Zaporizhia, where I come from, and something that would really instantly bring me back feeling this good feeling of home. And yeah. For me, that was marigolds, Chernobrivtsi.
Yeah.
Which is something that we grew a lot on our farm in Zaporizhia region. And I went and bought and planted them. And then every day, literally, it's like a therapy when I hear this smell. And I instantly is transported back to my home, to the places that unfortunately now are occupied. But thank you so much for that.
I understand it completely. It's a lovely, lovely sentiment.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for also stopping by and sharing with us your story, and hopefully you will be back again.
Absolutely.
This is your space to claim.
Yeah, I'm always lurking as a listener, so yeah. I'll be there again.
You're part of a Ukrainian Spaces family officially. So, Josef, thank you so much for this.
Thanks very much, Maxim. Thank you.
And for our Patreon sponsors, don't forget that you always get a front row seat when it comes to asking questions, whether you can leave them in advance on our Patreon space, or you can ask them in person during live broadcasts. Just let us know in advance through Patreon page. So yeah, and for everyone else who is considering to subscribe, please do, because we have some cool bonus stuff, and also you're helping other Ukrainian voices trend, and you know, to trend in the spaces usually are not very friendly to Ukrainian perspectives. Anyhow, this is all for now. Thank you so much for joining, spending an hour with us. Slava Ukraini!